Quantum Foundations review course. I am Matthew Liefer from Chapman University, and I'll be talking about quantum foundations for the next 3 weeks. I'm really happy to talk to students outside of class as well, if anybody has any questions or just wants to chat about quantum foundations. My office is 353. You can find me there most of the day. I need to start this course, however, with an apology. I'm really, really, really sorry for the way that physicists and the physics community have talked to you about quantum mechanics for probably since you were a kid and you read your first popular science books. Because what we tend to do is we tend to scare students away from thinking about what quantum mechanics means in any kind of a deep way. So I want to start by showing you the most extreme example of this I've managed to find. And this comes from 2013. It's a guy called Emlyn Hughes. I don't know if any of you have seen this video before. But Professor Hughes at Columbia University, he has a general education class in science. And he gives a lecture on quantum theory, and he introduces it in a very bizarre way. I won't be able to show you all of this video because some of it gets very offensive, but I'll show you some highlights. Hopefully, if this works. There we go. Oh, let's not bother with that. Okay. So let's see. Hopefully the Wi-Fi is working. So this is how he starts his class on quantum mechanics. Oh, that's not working. I have to change the settings here. See, there's always. Okay, let me do this. Let me come out of here. There we go. All right, so I don't know how well you can see this, but he has a display. He's playing some rather offensive sounding hip hop music. We won't bother with the sound. But the first thing he does, he strips virtually naked down to his underwear. He's eating a banana. The eating a banana part is completely random. I don't know. I like the banana part. So. He strips down to his underwear and he gets dressed in completely in black. This whole performance lasts about 5 minutes, by the way. So let's skip forward a little bit. He's getting dressed, and then puts on his boots. Then he goes and let's skip forward a bit. He goes and sits in the fetal position. Sits down in the fetal position here. Just waits there for several minutes. At some point, some of his graduate TAs come in, also dressed in black, and they, okay, let's see. So they come in with a sword, two teddy bears placed on stools. Then the teddy bears are blindfolded. So they both get blindfolded. I'm gonna have to stop the video soon because it gets awesome. The next thing that happens is there's a sword, and this is quite offensive to people who like teddy bears, but the sword goes through the teddy bears. I have to stop here, oops, because he shows a lot of imagery on the projector screen there, which includes things like, as you can see, the 9/11 World Trade Center. It includes some images of Hitler and Stalin and things like that, all kinds of things. And this performance art piece goes on for about 5 minutes. 5 minutes completely unexplained. this is the beginning of a lecture on quantum mechanics. And then at the end, he gets up and says this to the students. So in order to learn quantum mechanics, you have to strip to your raw, erase all the garbage from your brain and start over again. Nothing you have learned in your life up until now is in any way helpful to prepare you for this, because everything you do in your everyday life is totally opposite to what you are going to learn in quantum mechanics. And so I've been tasked with the impossible challenge of having to teach you quantum mechanics in 1 hour, what basically the most brilliant minds, Einstein and so on, couldn't figure out working on it their whole life. So that's how you inspire general education students to get interested in quantum mechanics. So I don't know how it makes you feel. It doesn't make me feel good when I listen to this. I translated this into what I think he really meant to say. This is what he actually says at the end of the video. This is what I think he meant to say. This is the subtext. You're going to be very confused by quantum mechanics, as much as if your physics professor did a weird performance art piece for no apparent reason. The smartest people in the world do not understand it. Therefore, I, an extremely smart professor, cannot possibly be expected to teach you with your small undergraduate brains this subject in a way that you can understand it. Nevertheless, suck it up, because you have to pass an exam on it at the end. So this is the kind of, I mean, okay, so this is obviously a very extreme example, but we scare students away from quantum mechanics. In particular, we scare students away from thinking about what it really means, as opposed to sort of just using it as a calculational tool. Okay, so a less extreme example, one that you're probably most of you are familiar with, Richard Feynman. There is almost no quantum mechanics book on the planet that doesn't somewhere quote this quote. Right? There's, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. Is there anybody here who has never read that quote before? I expect no hands to come on. Okay, so everybody's seen this somewhere. Appears in almost every popular science book about quantum theory and many textbooks too. I think it's an excuse for teaching quantum theory badly. So it's kind of like, if you can say that Richard Feynman thought that nobody understood it, if you're not going to understand it by the end of my lectures, then it's not my fault. It's the theory, right? The smartest physicist in the world was confused. Therefore, if you're confused, it's not my fault. So it's scare tactics. And this is very, very common attitude towards thinking about quantum theory. This is a slightly less known Feynman quote, though. So this quote here dates from around, I can't remember exactly where it comes from, but sometime in the 1950s, 1960s. It's true to say that quantum foundations hadn't really taken off as a subject at that point. So for Feynman to say that at that time is relatively reasonable. But what people don't often say is that he kind of changed his attitude a little bit by the 1980s. This is also quite a well-known quote, but not as well known as the first one. And here he's sort of a little bit on the fence about whether there's really a problem in understanding quantum mechanics or not. He says at the end, I cannot define the real problem, therefore I suspect there's no real problem, but I'm not sure there's no real problem at the end. And this is interesting, it comes from the paper he wrote in 1982. This is the paper where he introduces the idea of a simulating physics using quantum systems, so one of the precursors of the idea of a quantum computer. And at this point in his career in the 1980s, he's kind of started to work on the foundations of quantum theory himself. Within this paper, he derives a version of Bell's theorem, which we will talk about in a later lecture. He derives it as a means of explaining why he thinks it will be hard to simulate quantum systems on a classical computer. But nonetheless, he derives it for himself, obviously with no reference to the prior literature. And he also has several other papers from this point in his career where he's actually dealing with foundational concepts like trying to make sense of negative probabilities and things like that. So Feynman changed his attitude. The physics textbooks didn't change their attitude. They stuck with this quote. So it's not really Richard Feynman's fault, but I think that were he still around today, he would be who would approve of studying this kind of area. All right, so the point is, there's all these scare quotes. You're being told, don't think about quantum mechanics deeply. And the main message I want to give to you at the beginning here is, just keep calm and think about quantum foundations, okay? Let's treat this as a scientific question just like any other. Let's not panic that quantum mechanics is somehow an especially incomprehensible subject, okay? So in other words, what we want to do is approach this as a scientific question, just like we would any other scientific question. You know, if you were trying to figure out what is dark matter or what's quantum gravity or whatever, we have scientific methods to apply. And specifically, what we want to do, and what we're going to attempt to do in this course, is first of all, define the theory in a, as clear and general a way as possible, not making any unfounded assumptions that we don't need to. Try to define what Feynman was trying to understand, whether there was a real problem or not. So we're going to try and define that problem. Then we're going to show how we can use the usual methods. So we'll prove mathematical theorems. We'll consider experiments that have been done in order to address the problem. And we'll explore, at the end, the proposed solutions. Okay, so this is the rational approach to quantum foundations, where we don't panic about how difficult it is to understand quantum theory, but we try to calmly approach it as any other scientific question. So some people, there are some common answers to the question that may or may not exist that people often give. So I just want to sort of dismiss these at the beginning. Some people say, okay, well, quantum theory obviously describes a world that's very far from our everyday experience, very small things we can't see with our naked eye. And so there's no reason it should be comprehensible. You know, our brains evolved to deal with the classical macroscopic everyday world. That should be comprehensible to us. But there's no reason why the rules of something that's not in our direct experience should be at all comprehensible. So they say, you know, we just have to get used to the abstraction. Don't try to think about it more than that. I would say, well, the same is true of relativity, yet nobody seems to have questions about that. We don't directly experience the effects of even special relativity, and our brains aren't evolved to deal with that, but somehow we understand it. The same is actually true even of Newtonian mechanics, by the way. Newtonian mechanics, although people are often impressed by how much Newtonian mechanics makes sense to our brains, it isn't really non-intuitive. Like the idea that something just continues on straight in motion unless there's a force acting on it is extremely unintuitive to humans because it's against everything that we see in our everyday life because friction is everywhere, right? So it actually takes quite an effort of thinking to get used to that idea even in Newtonian mechanics. It's not intuitive, right? None of physics is really intuitive. Intuitive physics is very wrong and very different from reality. So there's no reason why it should be, why it should obey our intuitions, of course. Quantum theory doesn't have to be obey our intuitions, but there's also no reason why we shouldn't have a story about what it's about what it means. Just like we do with relativity. Other people will say, well, you know, this question is just about interpretation. It's irrelevant for practical applications, right? So I know how to calculate my scattering amplitudes at the LHC, for instance, from quantum theory. So I don't need to consider this kind of question. Let's leave it all to the philosophers. I've become increasingly convinced that this is a selection effect. Of course, if you leave aside the interpretation of quantum mechanics, then there's a lot of things that you can do, a lot of calculations that you can do without having to think about it. If there are things that you can do that do have to think about it, where you do have to think about it, you won't do them, right? Because you haven't thought about it, so you clearly won't do them, right? So most of the experiments that we do in physics regarding quantum mechanics are actually very, very crude, right? If you think about what happens in a particle collider, you have very little control of what's going on. You accelerate these particles to very high speeds, and then you just observe the random collection of particles that come out. And that kind of calculation, you really don't need to be sophisticated about the interpretation of quantum mechanics to do. But when you start being able to manipulate and control quantum systems very, very precisely, as we are starting to be able to do in applications like quantum information and computation, then the issues that previously seemed philosophical start coming up, start being relevant. A particularly common example is Bell's theorem, which is now becoming part of quantum technology, right? Which previously would have been dismissed as kind of a thought experiment back in the 1960s when it was first proposed. So the point is you can't find the applications of something unless you actually study that thing, right? So I think it's a bad idea to just leave these questions to philosophers. We should try and think about what kind of physics can we get out of it. Okay, so hopefully having persuaded you that this is a reasonable thing to study, this is basically the course outline. So I can divide it into three parts. So this week, we're mostly going to talk about what we can say for sure, right? So these are all things that everybody agrees are describe quantum theory. Okay, so we're going to give a bit of a biased history of quantum theory. I'm not a historian, but I want to make some points about the history that explain why we think about the theory in the way that we do today. We will review the postulates of quantum theory. This should be review from your quantum theory course. We'll talk about those quantum phenomena that are usually regarded as problematic from the point of view of foundations. So which are the quantum phenomena that people say means that quantum theory is weird or strange or whatever. And then we will talk about the most general kind of formalism. Again, you've done some of this in your quantum mechanics course. So we're going to talk about density operators and POVMs and CP maps. But I hope I'm going to, although some of this is review, I hope there will be some sort of tidbits of different ways of understanding these things as we go through. Week two I see as the real core of it, because in week two we're going to try and be rigorous and see what we can actually prove about the nature of reality if quantum theory is true. So, you know, you'll often be told in your undergraduate quantum mechanics things like, you know, systems don't have properties unless you measure them or something like that. So you'll be told like a lot of vague statements like this without much proof, okay? So what we want to do in week two is try and see, by trying to construct rigorous models, what can we actually prove? What's explainable, what's understandable, and what isn't? And then in the third week, we'll be mainly focused on the interpretations of quantum theory. So we'll cover things like the many worlds interpretation, Copenhagen interpretations, de Broglie-Bohm theory, spontaneous collapse theories. Before doing that, I will talk a bit about the classical limit of quantum theory, because having a somewhat sophisticated understanding of how we get classical reality out of quantum theory is necessary for understanding how some of these interpretations work. So that's basically the overview. By week three, we're talking about what are the options that are left on the table after we've done all this work of ruling things out. Any questions about that general structure? Okay. So let's move on to the first section. So this is going to be a very quick biased history of the way I think quantum mechanics was developed. I like to identify three periods of time, which I call the first quantum, second quantum, and third quantum revolution. by the way, this is a bit of a dig. Some people like to call quantum computing the second quantum revolution. So quantum computing happens about sometime in the 1980s. people start to think about that. They call that the second quantum revolution. I think that's totally wrong. First of all, it's the third quantum revolution, and secondly, it has its origins much earlier. So let me explain. So as you would have learned in undergraduate quantum mechanics, quantum theory starts with what is called the old quantum theory, starts in 1900 with Max Planck identifying the quantum of energy in the black body effect. So then in that period up to 1925, we have basically a series of ad hoc rules, right? We have E equals HF, we have P equals H over lambda, relating basically particle properties and wave-like properties, okay? But there's no coherent theory at this point. There's no quantum mechanics. And the theory as it exists at that point is self-contradictory, right? Because in order to get any predictions out of it, you have to apply these sort of ad hoc quantum rules to some part of your system and treat the rest of the world according to ordinary classical physics, right? But these rules are inconsistent with classical physics. Okay, so it was understood that there was a need for a new theory here. Tons of new phenomena were predicted and people nevertheless got by with the theory. Okay. Actually, I go through this in a bit more detail on the subsequent slides. So then we have the development of quantum mechanics, which comes first with Heisenberg's matrix mechanics, then Schrodinger's wave mechanics, and then the formalism as we currently use it was developed by people like Schrodinger, Dirac, and von Neumann. Okay, and that's how things stand. But actually, let me go through these slides here. So this I said already. So the old quantum theory is just basically a series of ad hoc rules that contradict existing physics. You have to judiciously choose which part of the system to apply quantum rules to avoid getting yourself into an outright contradiction. You leave the rest classical. So this idea survived into the Copenhagen-style quantum mechanics, right? So the idea that you have to split the world into a quantum part and a classical part to make sense of things just continued once we had the full theory. There was no reason why physicists should be particularly bothered by that, because they've been doing it in the old quantum theory for like 25 years. That's the way they dealt with the theory. The fact that it survived didn't make them bat an eyelid, really. And the philosophy of the Copenhagen interpretation made that into a virtue, like made that like this is part of the foundations of the theory rather than a vice. Okay, so the second quantum revolution starts with the introduction of fully rigorous quantum theory. But as you know, it was first developed in two different formalisms. And I want to argue that some aspect of that divide has persisted into the modern day. So Heisenberg's matrix mechanics, he originally had the idea, if you look at his original papers, he was thinking about atoms, how to model atoms. And he had the idea, which comes from the Bohr atom, that the electrons were in stationary states, what we now call stationary states. So they were in some definite orbits. And from time to time, they jump between them indeterministically. So electrons jump up and down. This idea is inspired by the Bohr atom. And he found that to get that picture to work, he needed the physical quantities to be matrices, actually infinite dimensional matrices in general, so what we now call operators. The idea of non-stationary states, so things that aren't energy eigenvalues, was actually added to the theory slightly later in papers that he wrote with Born and Jordan. Right, so the idea that you needed like superpositions of different energy states, that came later. Originally, he had a very sort of clear picture of energy eigenstates and jumps between them. So that was quite alien, but it was needed to complete the theory. Then we had Schrodinger's wave mechanics. So Schrodinger initially wanted to think of the wave function in quantum mechanics as a real physical field, something like the electromagnetic field, for example, a real field that permeated physical space. He didn't have a probability rule, he just had the Schrodinger equation initially. And then the idea of particles was somehow supposed to emerge from the wave dynamics. There were supposed to be some kind of singular solutions which looked like particles in there. That was his original idea. So Schrodinger's idea was like everything will be a wave, basically. The problem is that these solutions which look particle-like generally don't exist for physically realistic Hamiltonians, right? If you have even a free particle, the Hamiltonian of a free particle, we know that the wave function spreads out in time. So it's difficult to make particle-like solutions. And also the phenomenon of entanglement basically means that in this context, it means that the wave function, Schrodinger's wave function, is a wave on configuration space, right? It's not a wave or in real physical space. It's in some abstract higher dimensional space, and that's difficult to make sense of as a physical field. So in 1926, Max Born introduces the interpretation of this thing as a probability wave, just as a device for computing probabilities. Schrodinger later on accepts this point of view. Okay. So Heisenberg and Schrodinger theories were then unified. The first person to do some kind of mathematics towards unification was Schrodinger himself. Although this was before both theories were fully developed, so it's not really. So these days we tend to look at the Dirac and von Neumann's contributions as the most important towards the modern formalism. So that resulted in the modern formalism in terms of Hilbert spaces that you're familiar with. But here's what I want to note about this. So initially, there were two perfectly coherent ideas about what quantum theory is about, ideas that are not difficult to understand, right? Either you have definite energy states which every now and then jump, right? That's one idea. The other idea is that everything's about some wave in physical space. These are very easy ideas to understand and nothing puzzling about them whatsoever. But in order to actually make the theory work, Heisenberg had to borrow the idea of non-stationary states, which are very natural in the Schrodinger picture. And Schrodinger had to borrow the idea of probabilities, which were very natural in Heisenberg's point of view. And as a result, the final theory is a mishmash of these two ideas, and that makes it difficult to understand. It became unclear what the theory was fundamentally about at that stage. It lost its footing in some concrete idea about what exists in reality. So at this point, Schrodinger and Heisenberg points of view are mathematically equivalent, but there's still a conceptual divide, which isn't any mathematical inconsistency or anything like that, but there's just sort of a train of ideas which runs all the way back to Schrodinger and Heisenberg about how we should think about the theory, which still persists and still leads to sort of arguments and differences of points of view in quantum theory to this day. Now, the modern incarnation of this is what I'm calling the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space versus the Church of the Smaller Hilbert Space. This terminology, by the way, comes from quantum information. In quantum information, it's very common if you want to prove something about, say, a density operator, you know that you can always view it as the partial trace of some pure state, of some pure entangled state. Or if you want to think about a completely positive trace-preserving map, you can think about it as a unitary operation with some ancilla on a larger Hilbert space. So it's actually John Smoling coined the term the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space from this. And then sometime later, I think I originated this term, but I'm not sure. But anyway, there's an underlying philosophy behind these two points of view. So the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space point of view is that we should think of quantum theory as a dynamical theory, something like a classical field theory. Okay, so the wave function, whatever it is, should be thought of as somehow analogous to a classical physical field like an electromagnetic field or something like that. It's obviously difficult to make that point of view work because it's not a field in physical space, right? But nonetheless, we want to think of it like that. The equation of motion is the equation of motion for some field-like object, which we should think of as real. And we should try to derive everything in quantum mechanics from the idea of a wave function that evolves unitarily according to the Schrodinger equation. So this is kind of the point of view that if you take Schrodinger deadly seriously and follow the train of history, this point of view, and this point of view is probably the more common one in quantum foundations these days, leads you to this kind of view. In the Church of the Smaller Hilbert space, we don't do that. Instead, we say, well, something weird happened to the observables, physical quantities. This is kind of Heisenberg's starting point. They became non-commutative. Position and momentum now don't commute. But these are the things that the theory is somehow still fundamentally about. Then what we try to do is we say, well, if we have these non-commutative things, how can we make a probability theory over them that is consistent? And then you find that quantum theory is the only consistent probability theory over such a set of observables. Now, this kind of point of view really de-emphasizes the role of the wave functional of the quantum state, right? It's just something like a probability over what are the real physical observables. Now, I'm not saying either of these points of view is right, but it is actually surprising quite how much of the structure of quantum theory you can derive from these two starting points, which seem very different from one another. You can basically derive the whole theory starting from one point of view or the other. And that's kind of a special property of quantum theory, because if you imagine an arbitrary physical theory, which may not describe our universe, which obeyed this point of view, it's very unlikely that you would also be able to derive it from that point of view. So it's something special about quantum theory that it allows for these two points of view. Any questions about that? Yeah.
I wonder why the first one is larger and the second one is smaller.
Yeah, okay. So this will become clearer later on, right? So if you're dealing with say, a density operator, then if you think that quantum theory is a dynamical theory, something like a classical field theory, then you will view the density operator as basically arising because there's some pure state on a larger system, right? The pure state on the larger system is the thing that's like a classical field and that obeys the Schrodinger equation, right? So you would view that as always being fundamental. So when you see a density operator, your first instinct would be to always think there's a larger Hilbert space, and this thing is the partial trace over that. Whereas that's not necessarily true on this point of view. If you just consider the algebra of observables and ask what's the only consistent way to assign probabilities to them, you'll find, well, it's the set of density operators on that space. So that's kind of like the origin of this terminology here. And I also want to emphasize that although I think there's a continuous path from Schrodinger and Heisenberg, this isn't exactly the same. I'm not talking about the distinction between the Schrodinger picture and the Heisenberg picture here. Those are mathematically equivalent, okay? All right, so third quantum revolution. So starting in the 1950s, very small number of people, became dissatisfied with the idea that's common in the Copenhagen interpretation, which says that there's necessarily a split between the classical and quantum worlds. Okay, so when you're doing your quantum calculations, you always say something's classical in order to make sense of the theory. So if quantum theory is really our fundamental theory of nature, you should be able to describe the whole universe in principle as a quantum system, so there is no classical external world. Okay, so this was really the thing which particularly led Bohm and Everett to be dissatisfied with quantum theory as it stood. Okay, and so they tried to reformulate and reanalyze things. But I would argue that this revolution kind of starts in the 1950s. Obviously, it's totally ignored by most of the physics community for decades. But I argue that this is essential for the modern understanding of quantum computing, quantum information, and things like that. Because if you're going to think about a computer that behaves quantum mechanically, you have to think, that macroscopic systems can behave quantum mechanically, right? A computer, quantum computers such as they exist now, which they're not very good, but they're huge, great big boxes that fill a room, right? So if you think that you're going to have a quantum computer with possibly thousands or millions of qubits in it, it's going to be basically a macroscopic system, and you have to have in your mind that the whole universe or any system in the universe can potentially be quantum mechanical. It's not just a theory of small little atoms, right? So this was an essential step, like to get rid of this sort of Copenhagen idea that we don't have to worry about things because when things get sufficiently large or macroscopic, they'll always be classical. So that's where I locate the revolution in physics, but that's controversial. That's just my idea where it exists. Okay, any questions about history stuff? That was a very biased history, by the way. If you read some very excellent histories of quantum mechanics, half of what I said there will probably be contradicted by some of it. So that's just sort of my take on it. How are we doing for time, by the way? Okay, any questions? All right, so now what I want to do is I'm just going to throw the mathematics at you. You've seen this before, so we'll go through it rather quickly. We'll go through the standard postulates of quantum theory. That's probably all we'll get to by the end of today. So here are the axioms of quantum theory as you tend to see them in an undergraduate textbook. And I'm going to go through this in a bit more detail. You have the idea that physical systems are associated with Hilbert spaces. Pure states of physical systems are unit vectors up to a global phase. Measurements correspond to self-adjoint operators. A self-adjoint operator can be written in a spectral decomposition in terms of eigenvalues and projectors onto the eigenstates. And the possible outcomes of a measurement are the different eigenvalues. Then we have the probability rule, the usual probability rule. And then, so that's states and observables. And then we go on to talk about dynamics. So the dynamics of an isolated system evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. Notice that h bar is equal to 1. H bar will be equal to 1 throughout this course. So this is the Schrodinger equation. Equivalently, you can say that the dynamics is a unitary. It's described by a linear operator, which is unitary. So I here is the identity operator. Okay, so that's dynamics. And then finally, we have a rule for how you compose subsystems. So if I have two physical systems, then system A and system B, they each have their own Hilbert spaces. To describe the joint system, I have to take the tensor product, okay? So I'm gonna go over this in a little bit more detail to make some comments, but these are the axioms of quantum mechanics as you usually see them in, say, an undergraduate textbook. Okay, so the state spaces. So the first thing is we have to get used to the idea that the states of our system live in, first of all, a vector space, and then that vector space has an inner product. It's an inner product space. And by the way, I don't know if anybody is scared by this term Hilbert space. I used to be scared when I was an undergraduate by the term Hilbert space. But as far as we're concerned, that just means a vector space with an inner product that satisfies some extra functional analysis properties to make it to make it behave nicely in the continuum case, right? You can look up what those are. But quantum physicists just tend to throw around the term Hilbert space as if it just meant an inner product space. And I'll continue to do that. So in order to understand this, we have to say, well, why should the physical state space be a linear space at all, a vector space? And why should it have an inner product, right? So the fact that you have a vector space is usually justified by appeal to the superposition principle. Superposition principle is supposed to be responsible for interference, right? So if we're going to have interference, and you know, if I have a wave, I have to be able to add two wave solutions, and I have to be able to have, say, positive and negative crests and troughs cancel each other out, for instance. So this is usually mathematized by the superposition principle. It says, okay, well, if I have two physical states, then I need to be able to take some linear combination of them, and that should also be a physical state in order to be able to have interference like that. Okay, so that justifies why it should be a linear space, why it should be a vector space in some sort of very vague way. Okay, it doesn't explain various things. It doesn't explain, well, why should these coefficients be complex numbers? What's wrong with just having them be real numbers, for instance, or something else? And it doesn't explain at this point why you should have an inner product on that space, just linear combinations. Okay, so this is unexplained stuff in undergraduate quantum mechanics, basically. I'm sure you're familiar with this, but obviously the simplest example of such a space would be to just have a two-dimensional space. When we have a two-dimensional space, it's called a qubit these days. So if we have a two-dimensional vector space, we can associate a basis with these two column vectors, and we give them special labels in Dirac notation. So this state is either 0 or z plus. We tend to call it z plus if we're thinking of this as a spin a half particle. But abstractly, we sometimes label it as the 0 state, and this one. And then I can write a general state as a unit vector in that basis. So here's a general state. And if I parameterize it in this way, then the states correspond to points on a sphere, the Bloch sphere. A unit vector, if I consider a unit vector on the Bloch sphere corresponding to this state here, then this is the representation that we have of a qubit. And so I'm assured that you've seen this before, right? Just a few points to note. The two points on the z-axis, on the x-axis and the y-axis like this, are usually given special names. So the x plus state is basically 0 plus 1, x minus 0 minus 1. And similarly, y is, I think that should have been y plus. Anyway, I got these wrong. There should be, oh no, this should be y plus. Okay. All right, so those are usually given special names. And then the other thing to note is that because of the way this is parameterized, two orthogonal states are on antipodal points of the sphere. Okay, so orthogonality in Hilbert space corresponds to being at opposite poles of the sphere. Okay, so that's just a representation of the simplest Hilbert space. So observables, so these are the usual axioms. So the first thing to note is that as far as probabilities are concerned, if you only care about what's the probability for an outcome of a measurement, you don't actually care what the eigenvalues of the observable are at all, right? Those are just labels for outcomes of the measurements, right? So if I measure the position of a particle, or I measure two times the position of a particle, I have to do the same physical procedure, right? Those observables have different eigenvalues. The eigenvalues of the second one are two times the eigenvalues of the first. But it doesn't really, it's not a different physical measurement, right? So what really matters is what's the set of projection operators onto eigenspaces. So often in quantum foundations, we just work with the set of projectors directly and forget about the eigenvalues and the observable. So if I have a set of projection operators which are orthogonal, they project onto orthogonal eigenspaces, and they sum to the identity, so that says that they're complete, then that's often called a projective valued measure. And it just comes from thinking of the usual notion of an observable and just forgetting about, not caring about what the eigenvalues are. It's just the structure of the eigenspaces. So the other thing is that, of course, if all of the projectors are one-dimensional, so they're just projectors onto states, then that set of states is going to be an orthonormal basis. And in that case, we call the PBM just a measurement in the basis, in that basis, okay? And so in that case, the Born rule reduces to something which is, this is what's usually introduced as the probability rule at the beginning of quantum mechanics courses, so the mod squared inner product. So just to reiterate what's going on here, if, for example, we start with an observable like the Pauli X operator, we find out its eigenspace structure, so it has two eigenvalues, plus one and minus one, and these are the two eigenstates. That's what x plus and x minus. The PVM that corresponds to that is we just forget about the eigenvalues and look at the projectors onto the two subspaces here, which are both one-dimensional in this case. And then the basis that corresponds to is just x plus x minus. So I might interchangeably talk about a measurement of sigma x or a measurement of this PVM or a measurement in this basis, that all means the same thing. So here's another example of an observable. And the reason I'm giving this example, it's a three-dimensional observable, is that it's a degenerate observable. So it has an eigenspace. The plus one eigenspace has dimension two. It's the linear span of the zero and one states. It has two dimensions. And so the PVM here is the projector onto that two-dimensional eigenspace combined with the third projector onto this one-dimensional eigenspace. This isn't associated with a basis because it's not a basis measurement, right? This projector is genuinely two-dimensional, so I can't say that's not a measurement in an orthonormal basis. It's a PVM. That makes sense? This is just to fix terminology. Now, it's worth commenting on the collapse of the wave function, sometimes called the collapse of the wave function. So after you've finished a measurement, some textbooks will say that if I obtain the outcome corresponding to the projector PJ, then the state immediately after the measurement is this. Okay. This should be called the Luders rule because it's due to Luders, sometimes mistakenly attributed to von Neumann. And sometimes this is stated as an axiom, one of the postulates of quantum theory, okay, that this happens. I don't consider this a postulate of quantum theory because it doesn't happen. Actually, most of the time when you make a measurement, it doesn't happen. But if you think about, for example, a photon detector typically absorbs the photon that it's detecting. After the measurement, you no longer have a photon, so you don't have this rule. Okay, so this is an additional thing that can happen if you set up your measurement very precisely. A measurement that obeys this rule, I will call, some people call it an ideal measurement. But the point is, it doesn't always happen. I don't consider it an axiom, but it's something that you can, if you're very careful in your experiment, you can make this happen. Any question about that? Is everybody familiar with this way of writing down the collapse postulate, by the way? Seeing no questions, I will assume the answer is yes. Should I assume the answer is no when nobody answers? I don't know. Okay. All right. Okay, so dynamics. So the dynamical axiom says, okay, we have the Schrodinger equation, we have unitary evolution. This isn't really an additional postulate at this point. To be honest, even some of those other things aren't additional postulates, as we'll see later. But even at this stage, we can say, look, given what the structure that we've got so far, this is going to be basically the only consistent way of writing down the dynamics. Okay, so let's see why that's true. You've probably seen some of this before. If we have the superposition principle, so if we have two time-dependent solutions, then to whatever the equation of motion is, then so should a linear superposition of them be a solution to the equation of motion. So this implies that the time evolution must be described by a linear operator, right? Because I can separately evolve these two from time zero to time t, and this linear combination, each of the components have to be evolved in the same way, okay? So this has to be a linear operator, but then In order to conserve probabilities, the dynamics has to preserve the normalization of the states. So to see this, let's consider some orthonormal basis. The probability of getting outcome J at time zero is going to be this, the mod squared inner product. So the probability of getting any outcome at all, which should be one, if I sum over J here, I should get one, tells me that the norm initially of the quantum state has to be one. Okay. But now we can do the same thing at time T, and we will find, so at time T, I can, if I have this linear evolution, I can get psi at time T by applying the unitary operator to the to psi at time zero, then I'll get this, and if I sum over J, I'll get the identity operator in here, so I'll get that the norm at a later time is this, so, but I want this to also equal one, right? So in particular, I want it to be the case that this here should be equal to the initial inner product, which I can write as being an identity operator in here. Now, because this has to be true for any initial state, that will imply that what's inside here has to be equal. So it implies that u dagger u has to equal the identity. So from that, we derive that the dynamics have to be unitary. OK, so now if we want a continuous dynamics, we'll have to have the Schrodinger equation. So if we want it to be the case that at time zero, if we evolve for zero time, we have the identity operator, then we can say, OK, well, let's make an expansion in parameter delta t. Sorry, this should say u of delta t here, u of delta t. So for a small delta t, let's imagine that we have some small perturbation away from the identity to first order. Then you find that if u is unitary, then this matrix, this operator here has to be anti-emission. So its dagger has to equal minus a. The reason is that if I expand this out to first order, u dagger u, and I multiply it out, and if I keep the term, you find that the term of order delta t is a dagger plus a. So if this dynamics is unitary, then actually all of the terms at every order of delta t have to be zero. So for the first order term, we find that a dagger plus a is zero, so a dagger is minus a. OK, so therefore, if I take the derivative with respect to time of the quantum state, then we find, if we use this, that it's going to be a times phi of zero. And I think I made another mistake here. This should be a minus sign here. So if I define h to be just I or minus I times a, then because this is anti-emission, that will make this emission. And I'll get this equation, which is the Schrodinger equation. So the Schrodinger equation has to be true for some Hermitian operator. I haven't said anything about why that operator should be the Hamiltonian or the energy, but yeah.
Well, but I understand that you put it as a postulate because you're saying that you there always exists a parameter t that you can express these unitary operators and your dynamics, right?
Well, I'm just saying, look, I consider the fundamental postulate to be dynamics should be unitary. Okay. So if in addition we demand that we should have a continuous, you know, if you should have a continuous dynamics that starts at the identity, continuously connected to the identity, then you'll get the Schrodinger equation as a consequence. Of course, you need not have that. You could have a fundamentally discrete dynamics, or you could have some weird thing where from time to time some discrete unitary transformation happens. That would be consistent with the probability rule. But if you want your dynamics to be fundamentally continuous and to basically do nothing as the time parameter goes to zero, then it has to be the Schrodinger equation. Yeah.
Here we also assume that we can take time derivative of an object which lives in Hilbert space.
Yeah, sure. I have assumed that.
It's not justified by any means.
Sure.
Okay.
All right, so let's see. Okay, 5 more minutes. So this should also be familiar. I'm not going to say a huge amount about tensor products right now because it's going to come up later. But just to define things, if I have two systems, each with their own Hilbert space, then for the joint system is described by the tensor product. And basically, formally, this tensor product is the Hilbert space which is spanned. So if I take one vector from Hilbert space A, one vector from Hilbert space V, just write down this direct product symbol and say, take the linear span of such things, that's the tensor product, okay? But sort of more concretely, if I, so say we're in a finite dimensional case, if I have a basis, if I have a set of basis vectors 0 to dA, I guess that should be dA minus 1 if I'm starting from 0, anyway, which is a basis for Hilbert space A, and another one which is a basis for Hilbert space B, then a basis for the tensor product Hilbert space is to just take all possible combinations of those basis vectors. And then we can write an arbitrary state in the tensor product in terms of that basis like this. So just have one coefficient for each choice of basis vectors of both the spaces. So note that what happens to the Hilbert space dimension is that the dimension of the tensor product is the product of the dimensions of the two individual Hilbert spaces. Now, we like to get sloppy with tensor product notation in physics, and I will do this from time to time. Omitting the tensor product symbol is common, and even glomming the two basis vectors together into one, where that's clear what's going on. And even dropping the labels which tell you which subsystem is which. Because sometimes it will be clear from the ordering. Like I might, in some problem, always write system A to the left of system B, in which case we often even go down to something very compact like that. Okay, but only do that when it's clear from the meaning, clear from the context, what system is which. So we can obviously generalize this to more systems. So if I have a whole bunch of systems, then I just write down a huge basis vector consisting of all possible choices of basis for each system. And note here, importantly, the dimension is going to increase exponentially with the number of systems. So if you have a system which has dimension d, and you take the tensor product of n such systems, then you'll have dimension d to the n. This is often thought to be somehow relevant to the power of quantum computing. We'll discuss that later, because the number of parameters you need to describe n systems is increasing exponentially. Okay, I should probably stop there then rather than going to the next section. So are there any questions on, I know I went through that rather quickly, but it should all be stuff that you're familiar with before. But any questions on anything from today? You guys have no questions. Wait, okay, so I should ask it this way. What are your questions? All right, so if there isn't anything, then we will reconvene same time tomorrow.